Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Hello, and thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. Today we have a new episode and a fantastic storyteller. I have the pleasure to welcome you, Nurhan, to Urbanistica podcast. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Mustafa. It's so good to be back.
Yeah, how are you?
All good. And I'm really glad that we get a chance to talk today and recap because I think The last time was in Pontevedra. It was short. So yeah, this is a good opportunity to talk more.
Exactly. We did like this quick podcast in Pontevedra, ERL. And now finally, like a long episode talking about your work, your topic, and you, of course. Tell me, how are you doing? Because I saw you were traveling to Qatar with Ethan and the community.
Yeah, it was actually great. It was my first time in Doha, and we get a chance to see the project they're doing, to keep the conversation going, and to witness the Qatar chapter for the American network. So it was really nice times in Doha and warmer weather. So I think, yeah. You know, it was really much fun, and it's always, you know, very nice to see different contexts and to know what's going on in different parts of the world.
Exactly. So, to be honest, I can't wait to start talking about your book, your work, and the topic as well. So, I read your book, and I love it. I just want to say this to the listeners: it's really good book. It's open eyes, to be honest. Like, usually we talk about this topic, let's say women's in the urban developments and so on, but we don't, how to say, we don't stress it so much, or we read it not in this depth. Like, we don't get in touch with, the thing is, I love how you tell a story in the book. So you brought us closer to this perspective. So I'm very grateful that you wrote this, and now we talk about it more. So
thank you, Mustafa. It's so good to hear this from you, really. And you know, I'm always happy to hear this from male allies, I would say, because yeah, it's not always the easiest.
So let's start. Take us back in time. Like, why you became interested in this topic?
Yeah, so I would say that as long as I remember, I always called myself a feminist, growing up reading feminist literature. So this is something that actually, like, in my identity. But I am as well an architect and urban designer, and actually, like, getting close to the topics of community engagement, co-design, etc. It really brought me to feminist urbanism as a science, like feminist geographies, and how it can be an approach to urban planning and design that seeks to create cities and spaces that are inclusive, equitable, and responsive. And part of it, I mean, like you read in the book, it is my own experiences in different contexts and different urban belongings, and how me being a woman of color is different navigating, I would say, cities around the world. And this brought my attention to how marginalized groups, but not only marginalized groups, like we're talking about women, half of the population are sometimes excluded from public spaces or the public realm just because of their gender. So feminist urbanism challenges the gender biases and stereotypes that I would say ingrained in urban planning and design, and advocates for policies and practices that promote gender equality. And this is what we are working on, this is what we are seeking, and we know that hundreds of years ago, cities were designed and planned to accommodate the needs of males. This is why it is like it will take time to change this narrative and make it more like with many perspectives rather than only men. So we say that it is not about women as well only, but it is about the 99.9%.
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, this is what makes the book stronger, is that also it's your story as well. Like you, let's say, unfortunately, you have been through tough experiences in different built environment, and you write about it in the book and so on. That makes like an extra perspective to the book. You mentioned like you're a feminist. What does it mean to be, let's underline this word, because a lot of people talking about it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it for you?
Yeah, for me, and I mean in general, when you know feminism is indeed rooted in the fundamental principle that men and women should be treated equally. It's as simple as this. So it needs to be equal access to resources, opportunities, decision making. So it challenges the societal norms and structures that perpetuate gender-based discrimination. It seeks to dismantle the barriers that prevent individuals from reaching their full potential. So it is basically that men and women should have the same rights and to achieve their full potential. So it is very, and I think it's very logical concept, the gender equality
is, yes,
basically,
yes.
Like this deep comprehension that the inherent fairness and the justice behind the feminist ideals, and this understanding really helps us to shape perspectives in like in all aspects in life, that people need to be treated equally and be included in the society regardless of gender.
How like when you introduce yourself and say I'm feminist and so on, how does the public or the audience perceive this? Do they like relate it to this activism, you know, or how do you experience it?
Well, it I would say it depends on in the context as well. But I mean, yeah, some men still think feminists are this man-hating, exclusionary movement. So they always like assume, oh, so you hate men. Oh, so you're so radical, etc. So, yeah, this I face actually still till now. And I mean, even in Western societies. But I mean, it's very contextual. So I would say that in my own bubble with other placemakers, like network, I would say that it is, you know, it is known like feminism. It's basically equal rights, equal, yeah, it's equality between males and females. So I mean, yeah, it depends on the context. But yeah, it is not easy to challenge the status quo. And men are not always welcoming this word, I would say.
And like your book has the title "The Gender City: How Cities Keep Failing Women," and like why you use the word failing?
Yes, it is actually because as well this is the testimonies of different women from around the world and with different experiences, not only gender experiences, but I mean failing. It is highlighting how the shortcomings. It reflects the shortcomings of the city. It means how cities failed at some point to meet our desired success, our desired needs as women and all the marginalized groups. So it is important as well. It has this opportunity for growth. It highlights how to how failing can be and how not failing can be. So yeah, I would mean that it is the shortcomings of cities towards women. So yeah.
And when you say Nurhan, when you say marginalized groups, who are these groups?
Yeah, so we know that feminism is very much intersectional, And this is as well the brilliancy of the term. So it embraces intersectionality, and intersectionality is a term coined by Kimberlé Crenshaw, and it recognizes that individuals possess multiple social identities that are various forms of discrimination and oppression, intersects and compound within a person's lived experiences. So you can be a woman and as well identify as well from different race, ethnicity, class, ability, and more. So it is all these compounded together that shapes how we live in basically our lives. So you're not only like a man or woman, but you are as well from certain background, from maybe certain ethnicity, from different abilities. So this is how, when we say feminism is about the 99.9% of the population, and how it is brilliant and inclusive because it is intersectional. And we say that feminism should always be focused on intersectionality, and it means all the compounded elements that makes you who you are or position yourself in societies. So yeah, it considers the whole different spectrum of
exactly
belongings. Yeah.
So it's not only about the gender.
Exactly. Not at all.
Like the gender maybe could be one element, but there are many others, like background, nationality, maybe religion, maybe economical
class. Exactly. Socioeconomic class, ability.
Yeah.
Even citizenship, immigrant situation.
That's true.
A lot.
Yeah. So tell me, like, can you give us examples of how cities failing women?
I think as you read Mustafa in the book, basically, I think the most always stressful and stressing topic, it is safety and the lack of safe public spaces. Maybe especially at dark times in certain areas. So women often face safety concerns in public spaces. And I would say safety and the perception of safety as well. So we know that some parks can make us anxious very much because of how that the unseen, or you can't really know what would happen. So it's sometimes the inadequate lighting, insufficient surveillance, absence of inclusive design, like the eyes on the street or community being in some places, abandoned places, even the bushes that are maybe at certain height that can make people hide behind them. So I mean, it is always safety consideration, and as well a very important aspect, it is the inaccessible transportation. So public transportation systems that were designed by males for the longest time and still have very little percentage of women in decision-making positions, they fail to address the what we say trip chaining. And trip chaining means that these interconnected small trips that women tend to do because of the unpaid care work. And we know that women do the 75% unpaid care work more than men. And because of, as well, the gender gap of the pay gap, women tend to be the urban poor. So they are basically more prone to be in with the pedestrians, using public transportation. And we know that if a household has a car, it is usually the male who uses the car. So all the interconnected trips that women tend to do more because of these reasons, they for the longest in the transportation system were designed as leisure activities. So transportation systems neglected these trips, which is time consuming, money consuming, and usually burdened women to maybe have jobs or to be as males in as their peers in the time for the job. So these are two main aspects, but we know as well, as I mentioned, harassment and violence, and women usually frequently experience harassment and gender-based violence in urban settings from the unwanted gaze, the catcalling, and of course it can be very hostile than that. And these hostile environments restrict women's freedom of movement and contribute to their feeling of insecurity. And as well, when we see the teen girls' behavior in the playgrounds, and we know that the Moonga prototype, the multi-use game area, usually like 90-something% of the time, it's a teen male boys. So this as well make women, teen girls less active, like physical activity. And we know that women do less steps than men in the day, because they tend to, maybe in the end of the day at dark, they will take a taxi or an Uber, because the fear of harassment or walking alone at dark times. So it is really all compounded in many forms of, I would say, shortcomings or failing in urban settings that women and marginalized groups may face.
But this, like, how to say, it's on the different scales, one on like a strategical or policy level, on the maybe details, urban designs, and so on. Why you think, I mean, now we have been doing or planning and designing cities for so many thousands of years, why we still keep doing the same? Well, like, why we don't do the correct thing? And it's sometimes it's not like it's super simple, as you mentioned, like maybe the cut the bushes to a certain height, or lighting, or behaving, or you know.
Yeah, this is a very good question, and we are always, saying that, like maybe 30 years ago, when Dolores Hayden said what the non-sexist city can be, and it is quite surprising that 30 years later we are still there. We're still trying to make these design guidelines and tools to design with feminist perspectives. And in my point of view, it is always underrepresentation in decision making. So it is a bit as well a lack of political will. So yeah, it is like women are frequently underrepresented in urban planning and decision making processes. And this marginalization results in urban environments that not adequately address women's needs and priorities. So I mean, it is a lack of change of perspective when you are trying to include all the overlooked population. Then you are trying, then you are listening to the different perspectives. So I mean, the first step should be you need to be radical inclusive from governance level to the very smallest level to be representing a wider population. So I mean, it's always underrepresentation and decision-making positions that lack women. As you mentioned, in transportation, we know that mostly 20% only are women planning these prototypes. So I mean, you need, like, we need to be radical inclusive in representation, and representation is really key to change these narratives and to start building the cities that we dream for, that for all of us, for the 99.9%.
But tell me, Nohar, is it like the lack of how to say women in decision making? Is it because of there are no women like in this political game, or there is like if we take it back, where is the problem in this? Because maybe like let's say we say okay, in let's say in the urban planning department we have like five people and four of them are men, white men, one is women. Is it because like maybe there is no planners like female planners, you know? If we go back and see where is the problem? Why there is no representation?
No, actually, this is funny, because historically, if we mention historically, then we mention that there are always women in these positions, but they were never highlighted. And this is what you say as well, archival bias in even documenting women's work. And this is a funny example, because my friends in Copenhagen, they started to write a book about women in Danish architecture. And in the first glance, there was none. So it was like, oh my God, there will
What?
be a no book. And then when we dig deeper into the projects that were usually titled by the male in the office, or not even documented, not archived, they came up with a book that is as thick as this. So this is like how as well archives made decisions over the years, who are deemed important to be incorporated and to be highlighted. within the archival system, and they're not usually women, not women of color, etc. So I mean, no, there are always women in this in every position, but I mean, you tend to change policies to include these women, highlight these women, and give them a chair in the decision making tables. So I mean, yeah, it is actually a responsibility of integrating gender considerations in urban planning and infrastructure design in municipalities. So you need to have gender mainstreaming department in your municipality to gather as well sex desegregated data, to gather data to check what is working for women and what is not working for them. As we mentioned, the playgrounds is a simple example of it. It was always built the same way that the Muga prototype, over and over. All designers are making the same playground that is not like not working for teen girls, and nobody cared. But when you gather sex desegregated data, if you have like this department in your municipality in your policy making, then you will see that it's 90% males. Where are the teen women? Where are the teen girls? And then you try to, well, let's see why they are not there and what they need in order to be physically active in this place. And then this is how participation and community participation and placemaking actually works as well to tighten this gap, because you are asking the teen girls directly how you want to spend your time playing, and then you start designing accordingly places that fit their needs and perception of safety, etc. And then you're making places that are functioning more for these populations.
Exactly. And because, how to say, I might ask questions that have an obvious answer, but I need to put the devil advocates hat on my head. So let's say, like what you mentioned now is a kind of like action plan to integrate more women in the decision making, but also like as a end user when we plan and design our urban environments. And maybe like a city says, okay, why should I care about this? Like, why should I do that? Why should I spend so much money on making an action plan? We are doing business as usual, and it's like working and life is good. Why should I bother?
I mean, it is not really money consuming as people think it is. And when there is a political will to accommodate the needs of half of the population and more to build working environments, then I think it is quite necessary to do so. And when we say as well, and it goes for placemaking and community engagement, it's not really costly, but it is actively involving the diverse communities to lessen the segregation, to make women and girls and all the marginalized groups in your cities feel that they belong and they have a place in the society. I think it's a very important need. And I mean, it is, as I mentioned, not as hard as it sounds, not costly as it sounds, but it is a matter of a will and a political will, and as well, like it's a whole community will as well, because I always say that it really starts with every one of us to tighten the gender equality gap. So it starts with you, Mustafa, right now, right here, when you are trying to put a shade and to highlight on these topics. Then you are doing part of, you are doing your part towards gender equality. And I mean, it is really starts from even teaching kids, like parents teaching their kids about harmful stereotypes and about equal representation for men and women. And this is how it can gradually be up to policies and policymakers and governance levels. So it is really accumulative and incremental, but really matters from each one of us.
Exactly. And if you, Nurhan, if you envision and tell us a vision about how these built environment can be more friendly, should I call it friendly, or how do you call it? Like,
we can say working for the population, like a city that is working for the whole population.
Should it be like, because how to say, when I talk about this topic, especially now after Barbie movie, everyone say, should we paint everything pinky and so on? Because let's say, as you know, like the pinky associates with women and so it's a place for girls and so on. And now after the Barbie movie, a lot of people just like miss things with each other and say, but should we do like a Barbie movie instead of a normal city? So I love to hear from you. I love when you say it's for the entire population. You don't say, no, it's only for these. So mm-hmm. Tell me, how does it look like?
It's definitely not a Barbie land. And we say that we are trying to ensure, as we said, the needs that all the residents are met. So it is men and women, and we are only focusing on women because men were focused on for thousands or hundreds of years ago. So it is about fostering inclusivity and equal opportunities. And as we said, sense of belonging and attachment for everyone in the society. And it is not painting the world pink, but it is integrating the whole population and ensuring equitable access to places, resources, etc. I envision it basically, it's always important to gather data. So I would say that always data highlights the disparities and I would say always as well prove that we have a point why it's not working, because we have this and this percentages that are not, that proves that things are not working for the whole population. And then starting from there with community engagement and participation to actively involve these diverse communities, including women, but not only women, and then to build it up to the decision making processes related to these projects, to urban planning and design, and ensure that all of the needs and perspectives and safety concerns, considerations are integrated into urban development initiatives. And the goal definitely is to create cities that foster inclusivity, social inclusion, equal opportunities for everyone. So it is not about isolating, it is not exclusionary, it is not segregating based on gender, but rather about recognizing and addressing, as we mentioned, the systemic barriers and inequalities that exist within the urban environments. We know they exist, they have been for the past hundreds of years. And this cultivating the diversity, as we said, it's very intersectional. It's not about gender, but it is for everyone to thrive, contribute, enjoy their cities.
And Nurhan, is this like what you're telling us now, like how cities can look like and how can we involve community in making cities? Is this something like new on the table of planning and designing cities, or this is something I've been on the table for a long, long time ago? Do we know about this or no?
Yeah, of course. And we know that Umeå in Sweden, they have gender mainstreaming in their municipality since the 80s. And it has been actually a lot of feminist geographers, as I mentioning this for most like more than 30 years. It is just moving a bit slower. We are always on the positive side. And as if you read in the book, Departing from the Gender City, we want to depart from a gender city to a more egalitarian city that incorporates everyone. So there are a lot of, I would say, it is gaining momentum, and many projects are happening that are in that direction. It's more inclusive, it's more integrating gender consideration in urban design, planning and design, and even in governments and on a governance level as well. So data is being gathered depending on gender, so gender desegregated data, and hopefully we will see like sustainability. So equality and inclusivity is set in every policy and regulation. It's not an afterthought. It is a necessity while designing the project from the very first beginning.
Exactly.
It needs to be community driven, and this is how feminist urbanism intersects with placemaking in the feminist placemaking, what I call, and it's really a community driven. And I need to mention as well that grassroots movements, and that we are part of, and these community organizations are very much instrumental in advocating for gender inclusive urban design. And we have a lot of partners, amazing partners and amazing women doing brilliant work regarding even little advancements in some pilots projects. But I mean, it is always incremental and adding up on each other. So that's great.
Yeah. Sorry. And Nurha, you mentioned the pilot project because it's happening a lot, like different toolbox for how to say, a female-oriented place or a place for women and so on. How can we scale this up? Because what I am observing, usually like organization get fund and work and test and make like a handbook or a guidebook with this from this pilot project. Then the project start and finish after like 3 years, and then things disappear and so on. So how can we scale up these toolboxes and integrate them to make them like part of everyday life in the planning cities or designing cities?
Yes, I mean, it's always challenging to be it to be like from top down. So I mean, there are always our advocates, I would say, in municipalities or in higher position, decision-making positions, to make this systematic. And this is always a question of how to make feminist places or feminist design a systemic process. And yeah, this is when we say gender mainstreaming should be incorporated as a department in governance, and not only, like, as you mentioned, a project that comes and goes every couple of years. But I mean, I am very hopeful about that because I know women working with municipalities and decision making, and I know some municipalities that are open to have this systemic gender equality project. So I mean, it's, things may change for the positive direction, and we are always keeping ourselves positive about stuff. So we don't want to be, you know, very discouraged when. When it doesn't happen. But I need to say that it is not easy. It is sometimes you need, even not to mention feminists, you need to be very political about stuff with some municipalities. But I mean, the idea of integrating all the population, from women to the marginalized groups, and to make things work for them, is the, I would say, the end goal. And and this is like slowly but surely happening.
yeah exactly. And what you mentioned, Orhan, is more like about the politics, the institutional and the municipalities, like organizations and the system. If we go down one step, like to more to individual, to me, you, our colleagues and so on, what can we as individual do in order to work actively within this topic? Like, is the question of skills, I don't know. What can we do? How can we get better in this?
Yeah, I mean, we start with you, Mustafa, and we know you can play a big role endorsing gender equality. And I mean, yeah, we can start like by very simple steps. Like, you need to maybe mention your salary to your peer female colleague, so she knows that she is being paid less than a male colleague. So I mean, very simple things like this to endorse gender equality, like to highlight the pay gap, so males can really be allies on this and help us like know you're getting paid less than me. You need to get equal pay for equal work. But I mean, as well, you are an urban designer, and if you are designing a project, then in the first instance you think about how this project can be environmental sustainable, and then you think how it can be socially sustainable as well. Where are the women at, maybe in this neighborhood? Where are the marginalized groups? And you need to be radical inclusive and start maybe as highlighting who are your target groups and how you can build with consideration of this population. So I mean, endorsing gender equality, if you are like individually, it is really a job for every one of us to support initiatives that promote diversity and inclusion, to challenge gender stereotypes, to as I mentioned, to not make it an afterthought, to make it like the first step when we think in designing a project. It is how can women, what are the role women play in this project, and how we can include them and them being a significant part in the design of this project. And then, yeah, this change can be from the ground up, as I'm always saying with these movements. It needs to start somewhere, and the ground up is pretty much as important. So yeah.
So more also like if we talk about urban design projects or planning, it's more like questioning this topic: where are women? Are we making a place for them, and so on? And if in terms of skills, is there a skill that we should learn or develop related to this topic?
Skills. So I mean, it's always data and research. And I mean, this is very simple, right? So collecting gender disaggregated data, conducting research on urban and gender disparities, they really provide evidence for policymaking and for individuals from your own, like starting a project. So, and you need to as well check for the patterns that usually exclude women and marginalized groups. So avoid these patterns of exclusion. And it's very contextual. So as I mentioned that, and we know that from placemaking projects, participation plan, it's very contextual. It's very different. In some contexts, maybe you need to, separate women maybe from their husbands, etc., because you get very different answers of women alone than women under the effect of other males. So I mean, you need to be very, of course, cultural sensitive, context sensitive within doing these participation projects. So I mean, it is the skills of, developing participation tools, being creative, being considerate to what has been an exclusionary pattern over the years and try to avoid these patterns. And of course, it's always sex disaggregated data that we stress on, because as I mentioned, they highlight the disparity and then give the room to make it different.
Yeah. So like skills within analyzing data, gathering data, analyzing data, but also like in this leading or facilitating participation methods or workshops.
Yeah.
To be aware of this.
Yeah, exactly. Of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's like more based on your own opinion. If you see like four white males talking about, we are designing a place or a city for a female, for women, what do you think about this? Or like a two white male architects talking about this topic, what do you see?
This should be this should end really, because representation is key, as you mentioned. And if the other population, and not only women, but we need to see maybe people of color, people from different backgrounds as well represented. So we need really to stop. It is not like against white males, but we need to but we need to really see the diversity in order to take this seriously. We always love to listen from white males. We are having and not anything against them, but I mean, representation is really key. And when even if you're not represented, and we say this in a public space, you feel unwelcomed in this public space. And when you're not represented in a decision table, then you feel that you definitely your perspective was overlooked in a way. I mean, from decision tables to public spaces, representation is a key.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust them. I wouldn't trust them.
Yeah, because this is what I like. Well, this is what I want to hear the answer. Like, if you see a studio, architecture studio of like four white males talking about doing a gender equal city, or like a studio, architecture studio of two females, two males talking about this. So which one is closer to achieve this goal?
Okay. I mean, of course, it's not by the look of it, but the processes they are having. So we need to be maybe more to look into things. What are the processes you are following? So I'm not saying that if women designed it, it will be perfect. And if men did, it's not. But it's the process, it's the representation, and it's what the data they are gathering, it's everything. So it's not only like by the look of it, but I would say that if the firm has no other representation that than white males, then I'm doubtful.
Yeah, I understand. So it's exactly, it's like not only about how
yeah.
they look, but more also about like how they, who are then the team, what are the perspective, and if they really like bring it to the table, or they are like just silent when they do projects.
Yeah, yeah.
So
if the representation is there in the process, then it is, it should work.
Yeah, exactly. And Nurhan, and usually we talk about what can we do to make cities better and what can we learn and so on, like new things to do, to fix also. But in this podcast, we talk about what should we stop doing. So if I ask you, like, what should we, as a planners and designers, stop do?
Yeah.
Stop doing when we design and plan.
So we need to stop, designing gender-blind designs. So designing gender-blind spaces, it means that we are not considering different needs and experiences of different genders. And ignoring the specific challenges faced by women, it means that we are perpetuating inequalities and exclusion of women in urban environments. And we need to stop designing a stereotypical design. As I mentioned, designing in your office without, with the total neglectance of who you are designing for. This means as well, we are reinforcing stereotypes and gender stereotypes through design choices. So instead, you tend to have this consolation, active participation, and to know who you are designing this project, urban environment for. So we need to refrain from designing spaces in isolation. And this is very important. And I mean, it is important in everything as well, environmental aspects, human aspects, social aspects. So no more designing in isolation. And I mean as well designing what we call unsafe designs that are as well neglecting safety, perception of safety needs, and different needs different groups need. So we need to stop designing what has been proven as an unsafe design, unsafe environment for the wider population. So we need to stop all of these, in my point of view, in order to have a more inclusive designs that are working for everyone.
Yeah, and isn't too much for an urban designer or planner to think about all of these perspectives? Like for myself, I advocate for children in city planning and design. You advocate for marginalized groups and women and so on. Like for a person to have all these perspectives, isn't too much to learn about how does this place function for this kind of group, for that group, for this age, for that gender? How can we manage all of this perspective and plan for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, as a designer, it's not an easy job to be an urban designer. We know that. But it can be very rewarding too. And we know that if you are considering everyone and you have yourself a very active, loved, and accessible places for all, then this is a very big reward. But this is why we say that we need to like this gender equality to be not an afterthought. So when we learn even urban design and architecture in education, we need to as well embed gender equality and feminist spaces into the education of urban planners and designers. Because I mean, it is very necessary as well to be implemented early on. When you learn how to design projects and then we merged environmental aspects, local materials, etc., into the education, we need to as well endorse inclusive designs and feminist designs early on in education. And this is very much something that I have in mind, and maybe we will talk later on this. But I mean, when it is embedded earlier, it's not an afterthought. It's not after we finish the project. It is something that you learn early on and you do early on from the project. Like, we don't say that for environmental and sustainable aspects, right? So this should be the case as well for designing for gender equal cities and gender equal spaces. This is not an afterthought. It is our people who are living in these places. Like we mentioned, that this is our earth, that we are building these architectural elements or urban spaces as well. We need to be considerate to the environment. I think we need to be considerate to more than half of the population, right?
Exactly. It's a good point that you stress, is like to have it earlier in the education. So we have it with us, like we don't need to put an extra time to learn something. It's in our DNA as planners or designers.
Exactly.
You have been in touch with academia and so on. How does it look like? Do we have like upgraded, courses about this, topics?
Well, I would say not yet, and this is why I have a plan on mine to change this. But I mean, for feminist spaces or gender equal designs, inclusivity, or even citizen participation, it is something I would say definitely lacking in education and urban design education. And it is maybe we have seen environmental sustainability, as I mentioned, and vernacular materials, but I would say not in the systemic education, and this is something that really needs to change, and to bridge the gap between what is being taught in schools and what needs to be done in real life. This is why we have a plan for our FEM network, the FEM Academy, and it will be integral courses for feminist design and gender equal designs. So hopefully they can be implemented with an early stages in architectural and planning schools.
Through talking now with you and about this topic, it's big and there are so many different aspects. When you start writing your book, how did you manage, like, how was your plan? Like, I should focus on this, like, I'm interested in this process of writing a book. I had a like interview with Carlos Morena about his new book. I'd ask him like, what is the fun in writing a book? What is the boring thing? I want also to listen from you. Like, how is your process when you wrote your book? How was it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm very, passionate about the topic and very driven. And I would say this energy motivated me with this deep passion. That I wanted to make a statement with it, have an impact, and a desire to contribute to this topic, and to mention a lot of the literature I've read, a lot of the experiences I've had, a lot of the testimonies I listened to from women online and offline in different contexts. So it was a really, doing this work for me, it is, I would always call it, it's a labor of love. And I don't feel like work when I'm doing this type of work. You know, it is something that I'm very passionate about and very driven about it. And I mean, it is something that I needed to put out there. And I mean, it's not maybe there will be like second parts and more highlighting on topics of it as I go, as I grow, and as I see projects. So I mean, it is something that I've read a lot about the topic. Had this in mind to put it out there, and how and it has very radical pieces in it as well from feminist literature that grew up with me, and it's about intersectionality, it's about women different experiences, it's about historical disparities. So it was very much this deep passion for making something in this topic. It was for me, not fun or boring, but it was like the right thing to do. Like I should do this. I need to do this. I need to put it out there somehow, even if it's not the perfect a thing that is, you know, the perfection. But I mean, it is very much, you know, what I had in mind. I felt passionate about doing. And I mean, yeah, it has a lot of references, as I mentioned, a lot of my, you know, thoughts and ideas that I need to put out there, and you as well, terminologies that maybe needs to be like more highlighted and stressed upon, as I mentioned, as I grow and as our network grows, as I learn from projects. So it is like a project, so it's not only about growing, I would say, growth in this direction.
Exactly, because how to say, there is not a perfect moment, like, or a perfect book or a perfection. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we wait to the perfect moment to arrive, it will never arrive. So I'm happy that you put it in, became a very good book, and myself, I learn a lot, like when I'm reading about like new terminologies or stories and so on. So I think it's very, very good that you finally put your knowledge experience in a book that we can read. Tell me now, like, what is the boring moment of writing a book and the fun moment of writing a book, like the best and the worst, not worst, but like, let's say, boring moment.
As I mentioned, the fun part, it for me, like the How Cities Keep Failing Women, as well as questionnaire and the survey, and as much like responses I got, it was very much, you know, something I'm looking forward really every day to read what people get to say.
Okay.
So, and yeah, so their narratives and stories, you know, lit my passion. So whenever I'm like very consumed or tired, I read this and they say, oh my God, we need to change these cities.
Yeah.
We need to make an impact and make it happen. And I would say that this need and these stories really touched, really touching, and really, you know, it makes you think that this is an important work I'm doing and I need to keep doing it. So I mean, this was really something I was always looking for. The How Cities Keep Failing Women, and the narratives and urban narratives of people. And I mean, it's always boring. I mean, the logistics and of course, being swamped with work and other projects, and you need to still do this, and you need to put it together. And I would say that I am a perfectionist as a person, and I'm always not happy with you know, products I do. It is challenging in that sense. As I mentioned, it needed to be out there, and I need to you know, keep working towards this.
Logistics in which term, like the physical about books?
Like editing and you know, publishing and the publishers and the contracts and reading this and reading that. So it's always consuming it.
But finally it's out.
So happy.
That's cool. And so, like, Nurhan, when you read about this topic and experience it and so on, how do you look when it comes to the future, like future cities? Are you like, is it like something hopeless that we're not gonna fix it, or you have like good feelings and positive, no, we can do that? How is it?
As I mentioned, so I have my low days and I have my optimistic days. So sometimes I feel like, wow, it is going to be a long way, and you know, sometimes I get disappointed, discouraged by some comments, some things I see, some, you know, how it's taking a lot of time. And and as I mentioned, when and our network as well, you need people, you know, who are working the same things you're doing, challenging the same things you're challenging. So this is a sense of advocacy and you know, moral support, we call it, that, okay, so I'm not alone. There, it is gaining momentum, amazing women doing amazing stuff there. So it is doable, but I mean, yeah, it some days I see that, oh, this is gonna be like maybe for the next generations it's not happening as fast as we want it to happen. But
yeah.
I mean, yeah, on the optimistic days, and this is what we try to keep being optimistic, that we will depart from gender cities, women and all the marginalized groups will have spaces that are not restrictive, that they can resume their full potential. Gender equality will happen someday. The pay gap will disappear someday. And I mean, yeah, it is very much collective actions. And yeah, we need to start to keep going, actually. It is very much necessary. And
And for our listeners who are interested in the book, in which languages is the book available?
Well,
it's English, right?
Yeah, it is English. I'm not quite sure, because it has as well a lot of terminologies that are invented.
Yeah.
Like I invented some stuff, but hopefully, hopefully we can have the gender city as a movement as well, an advocacy movement in like the most famous languages in the world, because we have actually a big part of our network from, for instance, Latin America and from Spanish speaking parts of the world. So I'm hopeful it can be bigger and bigger, and with many languages, hopefully in the near future.
So the book now is in English. And it's available online to order as well.
Yeah, you gotta put the link there.
Exactly. And yeah, I have to say, I highly recommend you, like, if you listen to this, like, to really like purchase and order the book, read it, because it's good. It's good, to be honest. It's, for me, like, even if I maybe sometimes consider myself, like, when I'm talking to so many people, I think, oh, I know a lot, but to be honest, it's nothing compared to what is out there. So I'm happy.
Whoa.
When I read your book, eye-opener, it's very useful, to be honest. So, great. Good job, Nurhan.
Thank you, Mustafa. Thank you.
Yeah, and with this, so we move to the second part of the episode, which is about you. And I love it. Like, in the podcast, it's a great platform to know the people in our community and placemaking community and urban planning. So, I'm happy that we have the chance to talk more, to get to know you more, and take us back in time and tell us more about it, like where you grew up, how was your childhood, and so on. We're going to walk through your life until up to today.
So I have, as written in the book, I have a very diverse urban belonging, and I was born and grew up in Dubai. And it was really a very special place to grow up in that time as well. It was not like the Dubai now. It was this like expat bubble somehow. So I was in this bubble that is very much, I would say, different than the real world. And it didn't really prepare me for the real world. But I owe a lot of my feminist literature and gender equality ideas to my dad. So it's at a very early age, actually, my dad encouraged me to read feminist literature. And we are very much, you know, this reading family. So at dinners, we always discuss, you know, the books we read. And it is something that I was really encouraged to do at a very young age. So I read some Arab feminists and some Western feminists, and really got to learn about gender stereotypes and gender roles and how women can pursue the careers they want and their full potential. So this is a part of me growing up, and it was funny because I told my friends I'm a feminist in a very young age. And this is something that is not really always good, especially in some contexts.
So you born in Dubai, grew up in Dubai, then moved to Egypt?
Yeah, then I had my architectural degree from an engineering school in Egypt, in Cairo. So architecture in Egypt, you need to be an engineer. So I was an engineering school. And then I had the major of architecture and urban design.
Nice.
Yeah, so this is my professional background. And then, you know, I studied here and there. So I did a master exchange in Amsterdam. So I studied there a bit. Yeah, what else? And my PhD as well was in Cairo University, like on a Cairo context about placemaking, actually, but an exchange as well in Copenhagen. So in Copenhagen's Universitat. So yeah, it's very much, you know, as I mentioned, a very diverse urban belonging, because then I moved to Milan. Well, I live there now, actually, but I have this as well, some family in Amsterdam. And this is why I'm usually in Amsterdam as well. So I had some time in Paris too. So this is why I mentioned all of these cities.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite city that you love to be there or to live there? Which city of these you like to?
Well, I always say that Paris is my soul city with all the art scene, and I'm always happy there. But I mean, now I think growing up, I prefer smaller towns and less hectic environments. And I mean, maybe like a sunny Spanish city somehow with all the good food.
Cities failing women. It's up to you if you want to answer this question or not. Like, would you like to share with us some stories that where you felt that cities failed you? It's totally up to you. If you don't want, we can pass this question as well.
I mean, yes, a lot. And I mean, actually, like, one of my like, you know, passions doing the work that I do, it is about my own personal experiences and the fact that as well till now, and I don't say, like I mentioned, Western countries are better, because the same actually you know, awareness of time and how to get home, and it's all the same, I would say. But I remember a lot, you know, having panic attacks, being in a taxi or an Uber, having to share my ride with family members. It's always, you know, problematic to go home alone at night. It is you know, a park in Milan, it's very famous. So I the Parco Sempione, you know it. So I mean, dark, it is like, I usually do sports there, but after dark, it is for me a no-go. And when it is you know, winter, and nights are longer and days are shorter, then I need to subscribe to a gym and, you know, do whole different routines to do my physical activity rather than to be in that park. So I mean, a lot cities, like till today, till yesterday, I'm always need to be cautious of my surroundings and when to go home, and you know, and sometimes paying more to take an Uber or a taxi to go home safely. So I mean, yeah, it is a constant battle.
So you're not, how to say, enjoying the city 24/7, because like, during certain time, the city is...
Especially now I'm very much interested in After Dark and Women After Dark, and this is our series in the gendered city. It is Women After Dark, but sometimes it's problematic me exploring cities after dark by myself, you know, and
What, like, Nurhan, what keeps you motivated to do what you do, because you're doing a lot of projects, huh? And I wonder how and what keeps you.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, it is my deep passion for the topic, and you know, this drive of change, that change can happen, and that actually cities can be more egalitarian, more less restrictive to women. So I would say that it is, you know, always this labor of love, deep passion of the topic. And feminism is actually part of my identity, as I mentioned. So it is who I am. And this energy and motives come from the realization that I can make change, and a change can happen, and ultimately, you know, this opportunity to make a difference, and leave a positive feminist legacy that that drives the world to a more gender equal place to be. So I mean, this is basically it. But as I mentioned, it is always there's like struggles and low days and discouraged days and overwhelming days that of course all of us have. But I mean, yeah, it is the fact that we need to keep going and and have some positivity that things can happen.
Yeah, but with passion. Sometimes maybe you lose the work-life balance. How is it for you? How do you keep the work-life balance?
This is a very important question, because I mean, yeah, it is not easy at all, and this is actually something I'm starting to address, especially this year. I'm starting to say no, I'm not working on weekends, like this is a red line.
Good.
So no work on weekends, but sometimes I work at night and extra hours and stuff as well. But I mean, yeah, I would say that it's definitely not easy, and it's definitely costing me relationships and have friends hanging out and etc., and as well me being in different places. But you gotta to draw some red lines, and this I'm not crossing this red line. And for me it was like weekends, like now it's a no-go.
Okay.
Hopefully that's soon good. As well. No extra hours after work, and so we can reach a bit of the balance, but definitely not easy.
But that's a good achievement. Like if weekends are holy now and blocked, so it's good, really.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because I have also difficulties like with blocking the entire weekend to not work with something like I work with. So it's it's possible. I can see this.
Especially I have the urge, as I mentioned, I'm perfectionist. Yeah. I have the urge to finish stuff.
what is your daily routine? Tell us, when you wake up, what do you do?
Well, it's always coffee, and keep things moving. But I mean, some calls here and there, some meetings here and there. And
You wake up early?
I am a very early bird.
Okay.
So yeah, sometimes I even wake up like 6 or something, and I start my day, and then it's different actually, like from one day to another. But I would say that some meetings, some calls, and a lot of coffee.
And what time you start? You finish work?
Yeah, this is where I'm guilty at. Because sometimes it can go like really long till maybe 7, but 7, 8. And then, but usually like 6 or something. But I'm trying to make the balance, as we said. And not every day, even if there are days that are extending, work or having a meeting across the world. Mm. And then I'm not doing it like every day, and so it's on limits there.
what do you do after work, and what time you sleep?
I am actually very much passionate about sports, so I do, as I mentioned, some physical activities, and try to cook something nice, and it's usually like sports and I don't usually go out a lot, only in weekends. Yeah.
That's good.
But it's sports, and actually, like, I am an abstract artist, I call myself, so I love sketching, and I love to play with colors and acrylic paints. But this has been long since I last did this. But I want to as well keep on some of the hobbies. Sometimes in the weekends I start some of these projects,
I'm
guilty of that.
What is your cooking food? What is your go-to recipe? Like
pasta. So yeah, it is easy, and I do it good as well. Like I am a good
Yeah, like
pasta.
mastering it.
So I mean, yeah, I love pasta.
Did the like book took a lot of time of your time writing the book?
I mean, actually now, like with all the work I do, I feel less hectic. But yeah, sometimes it was some nights were crazy. Like, yeah, these working hours can may extend to, like, I don't know, 10, 11 p.m.
Yeah, that's fun. And tough as well. But how does it feel now, like when you have like a book and it's online and people buy it and read it and telling you, oh wow, I love it, you know, like you became an author and famous.
Oh, I'm not famous, not famous, but I mean, it is a very specific book. So when you read it, you need to be, somehow into like interest in the field, But I mean, it's really rewarding. Sometimes I feel, very shy about it, and I'm like, oh.
I want you to sign my book when we meet like
Yeah,
next time
especially when this part comes.
in the placemaking Europe week.
Oh, okay.
So like want your sign, you know, like
This is usually, the embarrassing moment when someone says, like, can you sign the book? And I'm like, oh my God. Okay,
write me like this. But it's so beautiful. In the book, like the first page, it's to your dad. Tell me more, like about this, like it's very beautiful and strong relation.
So as I mentioned, a lot of the person I am today, I really owe to my dad, and I mean this, I mean I grew up in a very non-traditional growing up phase, and as I mentioned, it was very much he encouraged us to me and my sister to be to read and to reflect and to decide for ourselves as well what kind of career we want to pursue, what kind of person we want to be. So he really he was a feminist man, and it challenged gender roles, and I've seen like how males can be allies in this gender equality process, and I mean, yeah, it is I think I got so lucky to have a dad like him.
Yeah, that's so sweet. And Norhan, if you choose another profession, like to work with something not related to cities and everything you do now, what is this profession? What would you like to try and work
Well,
with?
yeah, as I mentioned, it will always be related maybe to feminism and gender equality,
No, it shouldn't be related to what you do.
but I mean, yeah, I mean, this is like kind of who I am, but I mean, I am very much drawn into art, and as I mentioned, I love experimenting with art, but I mean, it will be as well maybe feminist art. So no way to run around
To
from
escape,
feminism.
yeah.
It will be
What is
somehow there.
yeah. What name something you're like very proud of, something you did. And something you did, and maybe now, like when you look back, you don't like, let's say not regret, maybe it's a strong word, but like you wouldn't do it again, or in that way.
I mean, something that I'm proud of, it will be basically maybe the Gender City as a whole, like as a book and as a project, ongoing project, design toolbox, a growing network of maybe now 160 experts of feminist experts, and I mean it, this advocacy, networking, developing tools, and the whole Gender City as a project to empower people to learn from each other and to put these topics out there as a part of the discussion, as a part of a negotiation as well. So I mean, yeah, I love it. I think this is something that I'm very much proud of, and And for the regret part, I mean, yeah, I usually don't, you know, look about, you know, not the best experiences as regretful, because it's like always an opportunity to learn more and grow and to learn from what you possibly did not optimally, and maybe try to, you know, learn from it, do it better the next time. And yes, I mean, it's always like a growing opportunity. But I mean, yeah, it's maybe as well related to me being very much passionate. So sometimes I'm like, yes, let's do this. And sometimes, you know, I don't really look into it. But it's mostly because of I'm very much driven and passionate about stuff. But I mean, it's always, you know, a possible learning opportunity from what you do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, use it as an see it as an opportunity to learn and to open new doors. So before moving to the last part of this episode, with all you do now and your work, projects, family and everything you do, what do you want people to read about you, to hear about you 100 years from now, like in the future, when they read or see Nurhan Bassam?
Well, I hope good stuff.
Well, let's see.
Well, I hope good stuff. But I mean, yeah, maybe, I don't know, like an Arab feminist urbanist who made cities or tried to make cities work more for women. I hope it's you know, a legacy of compassion and positive impact, and as you know, remembered as someone who has dedicated their life into gender equality and to make a world a better place in general, actually. Hope it's good. I hope it's good.
Do you think your book will be relevant 100 years from now in making cities? What do you think?
Yeah, hopefully it is something, you know, that now we approach gender equality, and there were some people calling for it in the past when the world wasn't equal, but now we're good. I hope they achieve gender equality by then.
Hopefully, and then they listen to this podcast and say, oh, look, this is the founder of this. Yes. So in the final section of this episode, three questions. The first one is about you giving a message to yourself, Nurhan.
Okay. Message to myself. It is So I mean, I always tell myself that I don't have to be everyone's piece of cake, and it is not always easy to challenge the status quo, and it is but it is essential. and we need to embrace the discomfort, and you know, this discomfort, sometimes I feel that I'm out of context or I'm not really welcomed by what I say, that I need to embrace this discomfort and uncertainty and learn from it. And this all comes when you push boundaries push boundaries for people who don't want to relinquish any of their powers. And and this really keeps, you know, life meaning and purpose, and the sense of purpose is really important. You know, you have to stay grounded to know what is your main a goal after all. And even if you're being like not really welcomed for what you're saying, not really loved by what you're saying, this is a normal, and embracing the discomfort.
And three messages to our listeners.
Okay. I mean it's very important that everyone should, you know, starting from today, to take concrete steps to promote gender equality in their own spheres, you know, in their own positions. You don't need to be someone influential or doing policies or anything to challenge stereotypes, and to, as I mentioned, support to lessen the pay gap. support women's voices, present the marginalized groups' voices. And really, really, I believe that every little action somehow will be incremental, and you know, to really create and will count towards creating more equitable society. So take a step from today, everyone, into that direction. And I mean, as we mentioned, it is not a man or woman, and the importance of intersectionality in that fight of gender equality. So it means that we need to, when we take concrete steps today, to as well empower people from the different races and socioeconomic mm-hmm. classes, abilities, and citizenship, etc., to as well lessen the different forms of discrimination and marginalization people can feel in their societies, to have less segregated communities, I would say. And before making judgment about any topic, we need to engage in ongoing learning and dialogue about the topic, and you know, be informed about it before making concrete perspectives about certain topics. So it is very logical that men and women should be equal. So I don't see why does that have to be so challenging, you know?
Exactly. That's so true. And the last question in this episode is going to be you asking it to us listeners who's listening to you.
I would like to ask what people think they can contribute to gender equality in their community, like in their different communities as well. It can be, you know, as we said, it's very contextual, very different. So what do you think the actions you can do today to contribute to gender equality in your context, in your community or workplace or your city for that helps? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nurhan, thank you so much for thank you so much for the book, and thank you so much for this time, for this good conversation. I hope to see you again and we talk more about different topics. So keep up the good work, and you're doing great.
Thank you. Thank you, Mustafa. It was absolutely lovely to be here and, you know, have this very holistic questions about everything in the world. I mean, we actually talked about everything. So that was fun, and always nice to be in your platform. And I always follow your episodes, and I find them really, as I mentioned, fun, but as well very important and collective learning and diverse. I love it. So you are doing a very good job, in my point of view.
Thank you.
Representing as well different communities, not only men and women, but you know, different, as we said, intersectional compounds. So yeah, everyone is welcomed in your platform, and this is, I mean, great.
Yes, for sure. So see you hopefully in maybe Placemaking Week in Rotterdam.
Yes, see you there hopefully. And catch up there then again.
Yes. Yeah. Take care.